If you've never seen Shakespeare's Cymbeline, or even if you think you've seen a definitive version, Fiasco Theater's hilarious new production at the Barrow Street Theater is definitely worth a visit. It's a pared-down, fast-paced, delightfully absurd Cymbeline that will leave you breathless with laughter and wondering how they managed to pull it off. Joining me now are its adapters, co-directors, and also one-third of its cast, Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody. Frankly, I could have fit the entire set in our studio as well because it consists of a trunk and a sheet. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you. Thanks for having
us. Why didn't you bring the set? Are you having as much fun every night as the audience is?
Oh, we are. It's been an extraordinary experience. We're having a wonderful time.
But Cymbeline is categorized as a drama in the first folio. It's generally called a romance these days, but it's not one of Shakespeare's comedies.
No, it's not. It's really neither a comedy nor a drama, and it's also not some nebulous third thing. It is truly a romance, which is itself a strong category of literature.
Have previous productions found humor in it?
Perhaps. The ones that I've seen have treated it with more of a heavy hand, and I think have gotten a little lost sometimes as a result of that. But we've found that the wild swings that the play takes from absurdity to poignancy to melodrama to philosophy are exciting. So while the production is certainly lighthearted and there's a playful spirit to all of our work, there's a tremendous amount of variety in the evening.
So when we talk about romance, we're not talking about bodice rippers,
right?
No. We're talking about – we asked this question of ourselves when we started working on this play. What does that mean, romance? And we came up for ourselves examples such as The Princess Bride, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Harry Potter. These are you know, or The Fairy Queen in Shakespeare's own time. These are stories that have wild sweep. They go lots of plot, lots of locations, magic and incarnations. And
archetypal characters that we understand immediately and don't have to judge for their so-called two-dimensionality.
But you also said absurdist. We're not talking about Beckett here, are we?
No, but we are talking about a deep understanding and exploration of the absurdity of life and nature. And that's both high and deeply
and
low.
Its randomness.
Shakespeare was dealing with those big philosophical issues, if it was really Shakespeare, of course.
Right, of course.
Yes.
In the original play, how many characters are there?
Ooh. I think there are, well, probably something above 20.
And you have how many in your cast?
We have six cast members, but we have 14 characters that we portray.
So you've cut out a bunch of characters.
We have.
Yeah, we've lost one large event in which the character Posthumus falls asleep and his ancestors visit him as ghosts, etc. So that accounts for a lot of those characters.
And you've also lost one of the most famous stage directions in the history of Shakespeare because you've eliminated Jupiter. We're talking about the Roman version of Zeus, aren't we? The big kahuna.
Yeah, what's the big deal?
You just cut him out?
Yeah, it's just God, Leonard. You know, it's not,
but,
you know, what we tried to figure out is what are we interested in what we think Shakespeare is exploring in this play and how a fate and accident and action and all these things kind of connect to create meaning. And what we found is that we never eliminated a character from the story that we felt played a role in the actual plot. Whereas the things that Jupiter has to say are primarily about telling everyone essentially to kind of calm down and stop worrying because he's in charge, but doesn't actually play a role in moving the story forward or backward in any way. However, the content of what Jupiter has to say was extremely important and interesting to us because we felt it was thematically interesting. So we found a way to preserve some of that text and incorporate it into our production.
What you don't have, I wondered how it was done in Shakespeare's time, Jupiter descending in lightning and thunder, sitting on an eagle and throwing a thunderbolt. That was what Shakespeare,
I can only imagine.
Said.
Yeah, well, Shakespeare had a theater with a winch that descended
from
the heavens.
They got really excited about the winch.
Yeah, whereas we had a budget of about $18. But as Ben said, we chose to eliminate that, not for necessarily for those constraints, but because of its lack of moving the plot forward. And
You have actors doubling on roles. How does that work out? Do you try to find Well, first of all, you have to make sure that the character isn't on stage when the other character is on stage. Is that pretty much what determines whether somebody plays two roles?
Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's several factors to how we sort of divide the doubling. One is that as a company, we feel very strongly that everyone who's in the show should have a big chunk of the play to take responsibility for acting-wise. So, you know, everyone has at least one kind of major role, but sometimes you want more than that. And so that's one way in which we did it, was to make sure that each actor has something else to work on. And there were other factors as well.
Well, for an actor, what's it like, because you're also performing this, what's it like playing multiple roles and having to quickly change back and forth?
That's a larger question for you, Ben.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the actors in the show play four significant characters, three or four significant characters. Noah and I play a little bit less because we were taking those opportunities to step out and direct a little bit more. It's challenging, but because of the way that we approach acting, we're really taking our cues from the language. So we're sort of, you can begin by saying, well, how does this character think and speak differently than the other people in the play? And especially with a play like this, where the characters are on purpose drawn with broader strokes and in more primary colors, you know, you can make those jumps quicker without feeling that you're kind of doing it in a fake way.
My guests are Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody of the Fiasco Theater. So tell us about the Fiasco Theater. What's the mission of the company?
Well, we strive to create actor-driven productions that are joyful and moving and linguistically and physically robust. And we, you know, we really do choose plays that we feel as though we can create for an ensemble. That there's no one person leading it. There's no star to a Fiasco play. We are a group of actors choosing to do plays because there's lots of for us to do within them.
So Hamlet would not be the kind of play you would gravitate toward.
Not immediately.
The Tempest.
The Tempest, absolutely. Yeah. And Cymbeline presented itself in that way. We thought this is a play in which we can approach as an ensemble.
But Cymbeline is not the most popular play in the canon.
No, not by no means.
Were there any misgivings amongst yourselves?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Selecting it?
Oh, yeah.
It's already become a legend internal to our company that after the first read-through of the play, Andy Grote-Lucien, who plays the king and Cloten, among others, turned to us and said, "Is it too late to choose a different show?"
That's funny, Ben. I remember you turning and saying that to me.
Oh, no.
Well, didn't Samuel Johnson say to discuss the play was, quote, to waste criticism upon unresisting imbecility?
Yes, he did say that.
And the final act is a problem. George Bernard Shaw wrote a fifth act for it and called it Cymbeline Refinished.
Yes.
Why did he feel that was necessary?
Well, the thing with the fifth act is that it is very long. It's got all of the characters are now on stage, and each one of them practically recapitulates the entire plot. And
why do you think Shakespeare did that? He was such a great playwright.
I don't know what his purpose was. I mean, how he did it is spectacular and miraculous. Why he chose to have it so long is both a question of the temperament of his audience that could sit through that and find it fascinating in a way that our audiences don't. And also, I think he was, you know, he set himself a challenge, which is to throw as many balls up in the air as possible and then have them all land in a, you know, sort of beautiful geometry all at once, but we decided that, you know, you can have all of those events without having all of the language.
Well, I would assume performances took a lot longer. After all, Shakespeare wrote five-act plays generally, didn't he?
Yeah.
Now we rarely see anything that is more than two acts. We somehow find a place that we can call the middle, and even if a play was originally written in three acts, we do it in two acts.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that those five act divisions are even in Shakespeare's time are a little arbitrary, but they certainly were much longer, much more linguistically dense. They were audiences that went to listen, to hear a play, and not to watch one.
It was part of the appeal for you that this play is less sacred and untouchable than some of the more venerated Shakespearean plays. You couldn't do this sort of thing with Lear, could you?
No, but it's not that you couldn't, it's that we wouldn't want to. I think that, you know, I'll be honest. The nice thing about the public domain is it's public, and you can do things without people suing you. But I think the reason that Cymbeline lent itself to adaptation and to conceptualization in this way is because as a piece of text, it doesn't, it had less things to us that we felt would be problematic to adjust or that we wouldn't want to change.
Where did you first perform it?
We first did it in the fall of 2009 at the Access Theater, not too far from here, in a fourth floor, although it felt like the 12th floor, walk-up space, a kind of open rehearsal room with about 60 or 70 chairs.
And one of your cast members was working part-time in a pickle factory at the time?
Yeah. Yes, he was, Andy.
Were you all working other jobs?
Yes, sure, we were.
So how much time did you have for rehearsal?
Well, I think we had about 60 hours total, which for a normal production would mean about a week and a half. It was very, very quick.
And then Jeffrey Horowitz from Theater for a New Audience found you.
He did.
That changed everything, didn't it?
It did.
Sure did. Yeah, he saw our, I think it was our final performance of our initial run, and somewhat cryptically called us in for a meeting, and then unexpected, but just basically offered to put us into a season. It's kind of an unprecedented, as far as we know, act of both generosity and daring on his part, I think.
Did you have to expand it to when you moved to the new Victory Theater?
Well, we made some adjustments. We got some new collaborators. We had a set designer for the first time, the great Jean-Guy Lacat from France.
Well, he didn't give you much here.
No, but he understood what we were looking for, which was a platform on which to offer the stage. And we moved into a 500-seat theater that was very Baroque in style, and we needed a design that could help us bridge the gap between those things.
And you worked on this together. So were you in general agreement? I mean, the reason I ask is Ben Brantley, in his review, suggested that you should be brought in to fix Spider-Man.
Oh, I'm sure we're not qualified to do that.
Oh, Ben, I don't need to speak too quickly. I'm sure we could find some time if they want to bring it.
Depends on how much money they're willing to give you, right?
Yeah, well, not only did we work on it together, I think in all fairness, Ben and I, though, we co-directed. We conceived it with our third artistic director, Jesse Austrian, and the play was created by the six of us.
And then during this whole process, Noah became engaged to Jesse Austrian.
I did.
You'd scheduled the wedding at a time when it was inconvenient if you were going to do this?
That's true. Well, at some point, you know, as an actor, it's never a good time to schedule anything. But we looked at ourselves and said, well, we're going to do this thing, and other things are going to have to move.
Well, you could just have done it in the last act, because all of Shakespeare's comedies end in the last with a wedding in the last
that's
act.
That's true. Now that I think of it, that could have happened, and it would have been much less expensive.
It's also that's the theatrical equivalent of the scoreboard proposal at the baseball game.
Exactly.
And Ben, you officiated?
I did.
At the wedding?
I did.
Is that like the captain performing a marriage at sea? A director can perform one within the radius of a theater?
I think that's probably right, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's completely legal. I think our marriage is binding based upon the fact that you were directing in the show.
Yeah.
So how much time did you get for a honeymoon?
We got 24 hours. It was delicious, and I don't think we could have stood each other any longer.
Well, you're working with each other every night.
Yeah.
And matinees. Is this an open-ended run?
It is not. We're selling tickets through the end of the year. You know, we're having a lovely run, and we hope that both Cymbeline and Fiasco will be able to continue in many other ways.
And are there any other unpopular plays that you have been looking into, hoping to make them into something interesting?
There
are a lot of bad plays out there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, one other thing. What about the music? You have original music, and people play musical instruments.
We do, yeah. You know, the cast is very musical. Everybody sings, and we take so much pleasure in making music together that we incorporated that into the play in a big way. Obviously, there are some songs in the show that are called for, which we've either written original music for or have set music that's in the traditional or public domain to those words. And then sometimes we've interpolated other musical events and songs into the show, either for storytelling or for atmosphere or for magic. And it kind of bathes the show in a beautiful kind of sonic fabric.
Well, Shakespeare had songs,
right?
He did.
And most importantly, he had music that was experienced by the actors and the audience at the same time and in the same way, as opposed to movie music where the characters are supposed to not hear it, but it tells the audience how to feel.
I've heard that you're planning to do something by Sondheim next. Is that true?
That's correct. Well, you know, we chose to call ourselves Fiasco Theater because we, as a reminder to risk a fiasco in the hope that we create something wonderful. And honoring that, we are taking on Sondheim's Into the Woods, which we'll be doing in August at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor.
But will you be sticking close to the text for that one?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is another case.
You're not going to get rid of Jupiter in that
No, or Giant or anything. No. No, this is a piece that we love. It'll be a huge challenge for us. But we will be attempting to, with 10 actors, which is a mighty small cast, playing our own instruments.
Yeah, part of what we're trying to find out is if our theory is correct, that, you know, classical actors who can sing can bring something unique to that material.
Meanwhile, we have Cymbeline at the Barrow Street Theater. What's the address?
27 Barrow Street in the West Village at the corner of 7th Avenue.
And I want to thank Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody for being on our show today to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry,
for having us. Real pleasure.
By the way, ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org.